You found the Digging Oak Island podcast. Podcasters' journey to find the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and thanks for downloading and listening. As always, I ask that you subscribe to the show on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review us. And if you would be so kind, I also invite you to join me on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Digging Oak Island. Today we're going to discuss both episodes 3 and 4. Since I was away last week, we weren't able to do a podcast on episode 3, so we just kind of want to catch up here. But before we do that, I want to read an email from a listener named Hank. Hank writes, "I listen to your podcast and love it. The only downside is you mention how the narrator of the show is. Since you mentioned it, I can't watch the show without thinking, quote, really, could you be more ridiculous every time the narrator talks? Keep up the good work, fellow Oak Island enthusiast Hank." Hank, thank you so much for writing. I'll certainly try my best to keep up the good work. If you listen back to my last podcast, I brought on a great friend of mine, radio host Chris Poe. Chris hilariously, honestly, compared the narrator of The Curse of Oak Island to the narrator of the old 1960s Batman series starring Adam West. And he isn't far off at all, let's be honest. The narrator of Batman was a man named William Dozier, and he was probably most famous for ending each show with that iconic line, "Same bat time, same bat channel." But if you haven't seen the show in a while, or perhaps, like many of us, you haven't seen it in decades, really, you might not remember that Dozier would also kind of pepper the show with these... I mean, they were hilarious. I don't know if he intended to be, but these sort of hilarious emphasizing type of lines, often phrased as a question after something happens, which we, the viewer, were supposed to think that was, you know, really important. Of course, we already knew that because we just saw it, but needless to say. It was really a sort of Captain Obvious type of moment whenever it happened. To best describe this, my favorite of those being when Marcia, the Queen of Diamonds, tricks Batman into a marriage and the priest starts to deliver the ceremony. Dozier comes on, explains, "Batman to become a henpecked husband?" And and there's just so many of those. He just sort of threw in these questions in the middle of the show. Now, thanks to Chris saying that to me on the last show during our discussion, now I just can't hear the Oak Island narrator without sort of picturing the Penguin or or the Joker. You know, let's use this guy's name, the narrator, by his name. He is a voice actor. His name is Robert Clotworthy, and he's done a lot of great voice work throughout a long career in this business, and is also notably the narrator of the History Channel show Ancient Aliens. I can't hear Clotworthy talk now without thinking of Batman, especially when he does his "a decorative brooch from possibly during the time of the Knights Templar," kind of, you know, that routine he does. It's the hardest part of the show for me, honestly. And as I've said before, I love this show. I really do. The cast is great. And the chance to see this incredible and historic treasure hunt unfold before us is something I really do appreciate. And I am really grateful for that. But it's the production sometimes where it falls down and can be so much better in my mind. The writing, the editing, it's all so cheesy. And the comparison to literally the benchmark of campiness in television, the campiest show of all time, is honestly an appropriate one much of the time, especially when he does these sort of question, emphasizing question things. Anyway, that's enough of that. Hope I didn't make anybody really mad by my criticism here. If you have any questions or comments that you want to email me as well, you can do so, digginoakisland@gmail.com, and who knows, I might even discuss it on a future episode. So with that, let's get in to episodes 3 and 4 of The Curse of Oak Island. As usual for these post-episode podcast recap shows, I'm not going to do a play-by-play of each one of the two episodes we're discussing here. There's really no reason for that. I'm just going to assume you've all seen it. But please do keep in mind that I am kind of combining both episodes here. I won't always delineate which one, when something happened on episode 3 or 4. I'll try to as much as I can. But we're going to do both. Episode 3 was called The Eye of the Swamp, and episode 4 was entitled The Lucky 13. Back in our show about episode 2, I mentioned that perhaps we might not be spending too much time in the swamp this year after all, contrary to what we might have thought going into the season. But now it seems I have to amend that, as it appears, despite the less than positive results in the core sampling drilling on the supposed ship anomaly, the SS Matty Blake, as I like to call it, the team is not done exploring the swamp just yet. In episode 2, we were introduced to a Dr. Ian Spooner. He has been a professor at Acadia University, Nova Scotia, in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science for more than 20 years. He is a geoscientist who specializes in studying, you know, a lot of different things, but kind of focuses on these kind of wetland environments. He's a swamp doctor, if you will. Back in episode 2, he did some soil testing on the swamp to determine its possible age. Much of the material he tested came from the core samples the team was doing, but we're told that he also came back with his own team to extract even more samples from different areas around the swamp. Again, he's looking to get a good idea of its age, and basically its natural history, if that makes any sense. Remember what we're looking here, what we're working on. This is discussing really Fred Nolan's theory that the swamp was man-made, and that Oak Island was once two separate islands, and that creating the swamp to join the islands is somehow related to the hiding of whatever lies below Oak Island. In a war room meeting at the end of episode 3, Spooner says a number of interesting things. The first is that he seems to kind of balk a bit at the idea of Oak Island being two separate islands in what we would call recent history, meaning the last 500 years or so. He doesn't dismiss the idea totally out of hand, but maybe I'm putting some words into his mouth here, but he seems to think that any two-island situation might be something from way back long ago. He doesn't say those exact words, but I got the impression that he was, you know, thinking of something more in the prehistoric time frame. Dr. Spooner says that the test results from the samples he took indicate the swamp is something like 300 to 400 years old, which, of course, gets everyone around the table very interested and nodding their heads in approval. But here's the thing about the swamp that is never, and I mean never, talked about on this show, and it really needs to be. Take a look at a map of the area, and you'll notice that there is a road that has been built up right along the southern shore of the swamp, in the area between the swamp and the ocean. Now, obviously, this road was not always there. I think it was built sometime during the early part of the 20th century. I'm not exactly sure when, but it is certainly 20th century. Get a closer look at it, and you can see how the road is raised up over the shore of the swamp by a few feet, creating basically a wall between the swamp and the ocean. I mean, this simply must have had some lasting effect and environmental impact on the swamp itself. Now, it's fresh water, so I can only assume that it must be spring-fed somehow, especially given how hard it seems to be to keep it dry. So most likely, the building of that road has had the effect of, I don't know what the word is, making it more swampy, for lack of a better phrase, more wet, considering the road essentially cuts off the water's escape route to the ocean. But it's never, ever talked about when we discuss all these possibilities and theories of the swamp. Later in the episode, they show an aerial shot of the swamp from the 1920s, and you can see there how much drier it is compared to now. Could this have an impact on these sample tests? Honestly, it's hard to see how it wouldn't, but it's never, ever talked about. I mean, to some degree, the swamp, or at least parts of the swamp, are obviously man-made, or at least manipulated by man the minute they constructed that road. If you look at the various internet fan threads or social media sites, you're already well aware of this, but if you're just a watcher of the show, you've been denied this little piece of information. Well, until now, I guess. But, let me be clear about this. I'm not trying to draw conclusions with what I'm telling you. There are literally tons of theories out there, and everybody's so sure they're right about this one. And, some of these theories make for varying degrees of sense, and I'm not prepared to offer up any such theory here, especially since I've never been there and examined it myself. But I guess all I'm saying is that it would be nice if we could have kind of an honest discussion of the swamp's history on the show that includes the building of this road and the impact it might have had on the swamp's environment. Spooner also calls the swamp an oddity, which is an interesting word, and indicates its unusual nature could be because of human manipulation or simply something in its geology that he just doesn't understand yet because he hasn't tested it. To that end, he points out an area called the pond, or what we'll refer to from here on out as the eye. It's a small oval-shaped area, water area, complete water area, towards the very northern point of the swamp, if you're looking at it like a triangle. The doctor explains that how there is all this thick vegetation that surrounds it, in the water, that surrounds it, concluding that something maybe peculiar could be stopping the vegetation from growing in this eye itself, or else it would, you know, contain sort of, it would be similar to the areas completely around it. Makes sense to me. I'm not sure if I'm explaining this right, but hopefully it does. And he seems to think that it has some strange underwater rock perimeter to it, which maybe he found during the testing or during his expeditions out there in a boat. Needless to say, he concludes that it is definitely weird, but offers no possible explanation as to what might be the reasons behind its weirdness. So naturally, the Laginas conclude the eye needs to be examined. Next day, they send poor old Gary Drayton, donned in a wetsuit, into the stinky swamp to probe the bottom and maybe get a closer look. Drayton finds a supposed rock perimeter and even detects iron along the area of the swamp floor. Now, what's interesting to me is the use of Gary Drayton here. Now, for whatever reason, they must have thought, and this is a must all have been off camera, that putting the metal detector guy down in the water to look for a rock perimeter was a good idea. So they must have already had some sort of idea that metal might be found there, or else they wouldn't have sent Drayton. They would have sent Jack Begley or one of those guys. So he detects this metal, but he's really in 4 feet or so of this thick and very dark water, and he's not scuba diving. So getting down there and searching it really isn't an option. During the search process, Alex Lagina mentions how most of the time when they're digging on Oak Island, they're digging in and searching in areas that are so torn up by years of exploring and searching that it's really hard to get any good idea of what they're looking at. But no one has really looked in the swamp much, at least not that we know of. So clues found here are ones that he says likely won't be confused with something maybe left by previous searchers. But let me refer you again to what I said earlier about the swamp and the effects on it by the building of the road. Is this really, quote-unquote, virgin ground, so to speak? That's a good question. Also in this scene, Marty makes an offhand comment, a joke really, calling the eye of the swamp the all-seeing eye. And then the narrator is off to the races, talking about Freemasons, George Washington, the Knights Templar, and the rest of all the greatest hits of Robert Clotworthy. It really can be exhausting when you go through this kind of stuff, but you kind of factor it in for every episode. There was absolutely nothing during this scene or through this entire search to indicate anything related to these groups, you know. But any chance the producers can get to shoehorn the Knights Templar or the Freemasons into the narrative is a chance they seem to happily take. Later in the war room, there is a nice meeting about the swamp with Tom Nolan, son of legendary searcher of Oak Island, Fred Nolan, who was known mostly for a lot of things, but some his work in the swamp was a big thing. Tom is now very much on board with the work of the Laginas, and I suppose to some degree also the work of the History Channel here. Rick Lagina indicates they have permits to drain the swamp, but not yet to dig it up. However, they're working on that now, so hopefully this is something we're going to do this year. They all agree, and I do too, frankly, that they have found enough questions during this search of the swamp to warrant looking for some answers. I mean, it feels to me like it could be a lot of just sort of overblown conjecture at this point, but there's only one way to know for sure. So to that end, they bring back a company from Michigan called Dammit Dams. I love that name. These guys build inflatable and portable cofferdams. And yes, you can buy that hat Rick wears on their website. What they do is essentially like using a giant overgrown and blown up sandbag, so to speak, to stop water. But since it's rubber and inflatable, it's therefore also more maneuverable as a result, which hopefully will allow them to isolate an area of the swamp to drain and then be able to work in a relatively dry area. I believe this is the same company who tried building one of these kind of things in Smith's Cove a few years back, only to see it fail and kind of deflate, I think. But they're pretty confident they can get something done here. It's a much smaller application, especially when you consider that, you know, the things they're looking at now, like this perimeter in the eye and the supposed stone road in the swamp, are pretty close to the surface and don't require anywhere near the space and size of Smith's Cove to get a look at them. You remember the one on Smith's Cove was just gigantic. You don't need that here. So they're hoping to use one of these cofferdams to isolate and drain an area of the northern section of the swamp that would include the eye. It would also include the stone road and part of the SS Matty Blake. I can only imagine what that ground will smell like when they take the water out of there. So let's move on to the next area of real focus in these two episodes, and that's a search for the original Money Pit location. Now, I know I say this a lot, but I really feel it bears repeating. No one knows where the Money Pit actually is anymore. No one knows exactly where Daniel McGinnis and his two friends started to dig. And the search for that location has been the primary focus of the Oak Island treasure hunt, really, for more than a century. And because of the various attempts, the ground under your feet in the Money Pit is also filled with 200 years of tunneling, digging, exploring, tearing up, all that kind of stuff, including the first 140 feet, which was essentially strip mined and cratered by a guy named Robert Dunfield in the 1960s, meaning that any evidence found there is really just hard to trust or even to verify what it is. But maybe, just maybe, they found a better way to the Money Pit. Maybe. Now, the Laginas have dug many a hole in the Money Pit area, hoping to find, if not treasure, then some kind of clue that might point them towards the location of the Money Pit. Now they're trying a new method, at least new for them or new for the show, and that is finding it by following the supposed booby trap flood tunnels directly to the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, so to speak. Last season, they felt they may just have found one of those box drains in Smith's Cove that were part of this flooding system, and now they think they may have found even more evidence of those drains a little further up the beach. Perhaps they can connect these dots, which will help them to locate exactly what direction the tunnels lead. It's a good plan, but I have to admit, it's one that's been tried many times before and has failed. So the area we're talking about exploring here is the few hundred feet of land in between the beach at Smith's Cove and the Money Pit area itself. This space includes something called the Cave-In Pit, which we discussed a couple episodes back in the podcast titled Core Values. You can have a listen to that if you want to get sort of a broader history of the Cave-In Pit. But essentially, it's a sinkhole that many people believe was formed due to the flood tunnels running under it. In episode 3, the team does some core sample drilling just off the beach on the ocean side of the Cave-In Pit. At least I think that's where it was. They think they might find some wood in these samples, or at least some evidence of tunnels or tunneling. But instead, what they find is evidence of dynamite. Yes, I said dynamite. You see, one of the brilliant ideas someone had, namely Frederick Blair from back in the 1800s, was to stop the flooding into the Money Pit by drilling holes in the area of what they thought were these drains, these box drains, putting dynamite down into these holes, 5 different areas, and blowing the whole thing to hell in what can only be called a very non-scientific attempt to collapse and destroy the booby trap. Needless to say, it didn't work. Shocking, I know. To me, this is really just another example of how poorly many of the former searchers treated the island. And Blair is one of the better ones in history in this regard, honestly. I have no idea why they thought this would work. And it's obvious they didn't care at all about what they were destroying in the process. Rather than cutting off the water, which they didn't do, they quite possibly may have blown, literally and figuratively, any chance at discovering these tunnels and working out an actual effective way to stop them. I mean, really, it's madness. But Blair's little Wile E. Coyote incident wasn't a total waste. Here is what Paul Troutman writes on the Oak Island Tour's website about this little escapade. Quote, the company directors decided the best place, and I'm giving you this because I want to give you some more detail as to what this actually was all about. Company directors decided the best place to stop the flow was at Smith's Cove. Their plan was to set up charges of dynamite underground near the shore. This, they hoped, would demolish the bothersome tunnel for good. Five holes were bored in a line about 50 feet up from the high water mark at Smith's Cove. They were spaced 15 feet apart, the first at a point of 30 feet south of the presumed course of the flood tunnel, and the last about 30 feet north of that point. All but the third hole were bored to about 90 feet without encountering water. They were crammed with dynamite and filled with water, which served as a plug. When the dynamite was set off, the water sprayed more than 100 feet into the air. The third hole apparently bored into the flood tunnel. At 80 feet, the auger struck rocks, and seawater immediately rose up to the tide level. This hole was filled with a huge 160-pound charge. According to Blair, when it was detonated, the water in both the money pit and the cave-in pit boiled and foamed, he's quoting here, boiled and foamed for a considerable time, and after the disturbance subsided, the oil and the dynamite showed on the water in both of these pits. That's the end of the quote. So maybe working in this area, specifically the cave-in pit, might not be a fool's errand after all, seeing that it might actually connect somehow to the money pit in this flood system. In fact, they may just be onto something. And there seems to be a little more evidence of that something in episode 4 when they pull some wood out of another core sample. So at the start of episode 4, the team is drilling just inland off Smith's Cove again, in this kind of same area between the beach and the cave-in pit. And at a depth of 51 feet, much shallower than these areas that Blair was talking about, they find wood within the core sample. Now remember, they have to extrapolate a bit here since they're only getting a coring sample. That's like maybe just a few inches in diameter. But it seems like a chunk out of a beam. Two beams, in fact. It looks like one beam and then another about 3 or 4 feet below it. Now, that's, of course, if I'm following the logic they're giving to us in this scene, which sometimes is hard to do. They conclude it's a tunnel. It's something of a leap of that logic, I know. But it makes some sense for sure when you think about it. Researcher Paul Troutman points out that there are no historical records of tunneling here, making this discovery even more significant. But there's one thing I have tried to get across to you, dear listener. It is that historical records of the workings on Oak Island are often not worth the paper they're even written on. While we may not have a specific record of two wood beams being placed 3 or 4 feet apart at a depth of around 50 feet, we do have records of a lot of work done in this area. Like I said, people have been trying to find and block the flood tunnel since the discovery of the significance of Smith's Cove centuries ago. Besides the aforementioned dynamite shenanigans, we know of searchers who've tried driving wood piles or beams into the ground there in an attempt to stop the flooding. So what we know is that there is some very invasive and ambitious work that was done there. And therefore, we can certainly conclude, after all we know, that even more work was done. We just don't know about it. Nobody bothered to write it down, since that seems to be the case over the centuries throughout all the work on the island. Another thing worth questioning is the idea that these flood tunnels would be made of wood in the first place. Now, if we're to accept that what they found last year in Smith's Cove was indeed part of the booby trap system, and also looking at historical records of these same supposed drains in Smith's Cove, that information would lead us to believe that they're made of stone. So are we saying that somewhere along the line, the system that they used changed from the construction of stone to wood? You know, if you're trying to create an underground system of moving large amounts of salt water, especially one that might need to last for years and years, would stone not be better for that purpose than wood? Wouldn't drains, made of wood decay very rapidly compared to stone? Maybe that explains the sinkhole being created, but it still seems a little illogical to me. Now, having said that, Rick says something in the Talking Head segment that's intriguing. By Talking Head segment, I mean it's one of those scenes where they're just sort of sitting in a studio or someplace and talking straight to the camera. He says they found these beams, and directly above and below them is what he called, quote-unquote, virgin ground. Now, that's interesting for sure. Since that would seem to indicate that it was not put there from a searcher who's digging a hole straight down from the surface, you know, searching for the flood system, then you would find, you know, wood certainly above it or the soil certainly above it, you know, dug up and evidence of it being disturbed. In the war room after this wood is discovered, Gary Drayton notes that the wood itself appears, to him at least, to be very similar to the wood beams which made up the slipway found in Smith's Cove last year. Those were rather accurately dated to around the 1770 mark using a method of testing called dendrochronology, which is the process of, really, of aging a tree by counting the rings inside of a trunk. They can't do that here with this wood, since you would need, you know, an intact log, so to speak, for, you know, for that purpose, so that you can make sure you're counting all the rings. So as a result, Craig Tester suggests something called a C14 test instead of using dendrochronology. So let me try and explain this if I can, though I'm 100% sure I won't be totally accurate here, as I'm going to try to go off what is probably memories from college over 20 years ago. But C14 testing is also loosely referred to as carbon dating. It's a method that that approximates an organic material's age. Plants, like the trees these beams are made out of, and these, you know, the wood all over the place here, really, they contain carbon from the atmosphere that they use in the process of photosynthesis. When the tree dies, this level of carbon inside it slowly begins to drop over the years. And the test can, I think, approximate the date of when it died by measuring how much carbon is now missing from it. Does that make sense? Again, that can all be wrong, but you get the idea. It's a method of dating that, in fact, goes back decades, I think to the mid-20th century, and certainly has its challenges and the potential pitfalls. And you hear a lot of people, talking about it like it's not completely accurate. But it can at least offer an idea or a time frame of when the tree was cut down and therefore used. It might not give us an exact year, but, you know, it's something. It could give us a time frame, give us an idea. Later in the show, the test results come back, and they give an approximate time frame of 1730s through 1780s. Now, in my mind, that's a positive result, since the very top of the range is still before the discovery of the money pit. And it also correlates with Drayton's theory of somehow relating it to the wood from the slipway. Like I said, they just might be onto something here with this. A couple of episodes back, I mentioned how I was excited about the addition to the cast of Surveyor Steve Guptill. And here we really see the results of what he can bring to the show. Using his GPS plotting and his surveying techniques, he's able to clearly show us how this drill hole where they found the wood basically sits on a straight line leading from the U-shaped structure all the way in, you know, into Smith's Cove and possibly past this box drain they found, past the cave-in pit, all the way up to the money pit. If we can perhaps find maybe even a few more points on this line to plot, then maybe, just maybe, the location of the money pit might not be that far out of reach. Let me end this segment by saying this. I've been very skeptical of finding things in the swamp for some time. I think you guys know that pretty well already. But finding the money pit and truly uncovering something akin to a booby trap flood system, now that's exciting stuff, and that would be a real eye-opener for the skeptics. Now finally, I really want to mention another big find from metal detecting guru Gary Drayton. Now seriously, where would this show be without Drayton? Sure, maybe some other metal detecting expert would find the things he's found. Maybe not, I don't know. But finding someone who can do all that and be as good for television as Drayton is, I doubt that kind of metal detector comes along every day. His personality, his enthusiasm is really infectious and just plain fun to watch. And with this find we're about to talk about, we get Drayton once again hitting level 10 over something that at first glance looks like a clump of dirt he pulled out of the ground. Drayton and Charles Barkhouse head back to Lot 21, the far western side of the island, on the southern shore, but it's the complete other side of the island from Smith's Cove and the Money Pit. It's right by where the causeway comes on, if memory serves, and it's near where original Money Pit discoverer Daniel McGinnis once had a home. The foundation is still there. Drayton has made many a big find on Lot 21, including one of those Bobby Dazzler brooches, a piece of something the show interpreted as part of a military French military hat ornament, and also the strange piece of lead that dated to exactly the same time and origin as the famous cross found in Smith's Cove. The fact that so many artifacts have been found on Lot 21 And also how the team has spent so much time exploring there is really one of the great puzzles for us viewers, if I'm honest. Why would so much stuff be found so far from the money pit and all the work done there over the years? If you're looking to find things dropped by men working on a difficult manual labor project, which this most certainly must have been, you would expect to find these kinds of things nearest to the location of that work. Think about it. If you're carrying heavy stuff, swinging a hammer, thrusting a shovel into the ground, that's when stuff falls off you and out of your pockets and quickly gets lost in the dirt that you're moving around. But as far as we know, no such work was done near Lot 21. Certainly nothing from before the discovery of the money pit. So the question then is, would these artifacts be connected instead to McGinnis himself? Or whoever else may have lived there during the last two centuries? Rather than to the originators of the money pit, if I'm making sense. It's an interesting question to ponder. Either way, Drayton finds yet another fascinating artifact on Lot 21. This time, he and Barkhouse find what he calls another brooch or a pin, some type of ornamental pin or like a piece of jewelry. Now, before we get deeper into this find, I want to point out something to the skeptics here. Many internet detractors believe that these scenes, the ones where Drayton finds something and another member of the cast has the shovel and digs it up, many people feel that these are staged. And I have to admit, sometimes I find them a little unbelievable as well, at least to some level. I mean, if you think back to things like the cross, the famous cross, Drayton just seems to like detect and then they, you know, move a rock on a beach. And there it is, and it really often beggars belief. At best, many of the skeptics think Drayton finds these things sort of off camera, and then the producers stage these scenes later on for the cameras themselves. But that really doesn't seem to be the case here. Now, when Barkhouse places his shovel into the ground, it really does look to be an untouched area of grass. I don't know. Anyway, I digress, really. Drayton and Barkhouse pull out a ball of dirt, and as they clean it off, we can see it's some kind of leaf design sitting on top of what, at least to me and Drayton as well, appears to be a stacked double coil of ship's line. At some point, one of these guys mentions that it appears to be a pin or a brooch because they notice two raised areas on the back of it that would indicate where the pin mechanism would be mounted to it. I gotta say, it's really a beautiful piece. I can't recall if Drayton mentions if the metal detector hit was suggested non-ferrous metal or not, but at first glance, it almost looked to me like copper or perhaps old and degraded silver. When we see these things in these quick shots on television, and also keeping in mind that it's just removed from a centuries-old dirt tomb, it's really hard to glean any real information off them. So they take the piece to Kelly Barassa, a conservator at the at Acadia University, who we saw earlier in the season, and he cleans it up and gives us a better look. He does not offer any specific date or even any time frame, but he certainly is impressed. You can tell that. We can rest assured more research into its age is coming in future episodes. So let's wait on that rather than speculate too much. It certainly doesn't appear to be modern. But even a few short years underground can really take the shine off the nicest piece of jewelry, let's face it. What I can say is probably what you're thinking about it, too. It's clearly not a simple or primitive item, to use that phrase. The cross looked to me like something made by someone who isn't really an artisan or an artist, you know. But not this piece. This is an ornate, very complicated and detailed design created by someone who, you would think, did this kind of thing for a living. So when Drayton calls it a, quote, high-end piece of jewelry, unquote, I would tend to agree. I also do agree with Barassa, who, when he says that it appears to have a, quote, unquote, maritime look to it, and that it clearly, and he's referring there clearly to the rope design. I mean, a leaf has been used symbolically in so many places, it's hard to pin that aspect of the piece down to anything in particular, but the ropes really do look like a ship's line to me. Now, Marty Lagina counts the branches of the tree, declares that there is 13, and then the narrator goes into another Batman-style meltdown comparing it to the famous Appeal to Heaven flag, which traces back to the Revolution, George Washington, who was a Freemason, and yada, yada, yada. Now, usually I dump on these kinds of pontifications from the narrator, which I've already done a few times in this episode. But believe it or not, I'm not going to do that here. Remember when I said just a couple seconds ago that it was the rope part of the piece that makes it look nautical? Well, in this very specific context of Washington, the leaf also points to a definitively nautical origin. The pine tree flag, or appeal to heaven flag, as it's often called since the words appeal to heaven would sometimes appear on the flag, was first adopted by Washington for use, you guessed it, on the first squadron of six ships commissioned by Washington himself in 1775 for use in the newly created Continental Navy. In fact, the pine tree design was depicted on the ensigns of merchant ships from New England going back nearly a century before the War of Independence. Can I also just point out that these flags didn't always have 13 branches? Not even Washington's battle flags always did. That's a little tidbit that's sketchy at best, but still, this is an incredible find. Do I think this means this artifact is proof that Washington and a gang of Freemasons sailed to Oak Island to dig up a treasure they used to fund the war against the British? No, at this point, I think that's kind of a giant-sized stretch to get all the way to that conclusion. But we also can't dismiss it entirely out of hand. Without getting some more information on this item's age and makeup, we simply can't call it evidence of really anything just yet. But man, it's intriguing. Another great plot twist brought to you by Gary Drayton. By the way, you can buy his hats too. So that's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. We'll be back next week for another deep dive into, this time, episode 5 of The Curse of Oak Island. Like I said earlier in the show, if you want to email something to me, you have a theory, a question, a comment, something you want to discuss, please do so at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. I've read a few of these on podcasts in the past, and I plan on continuing to do so. So that's really the best way to kind of get in touch with me and get something right in front of me. We also are on social media. Right now we're only on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us at Diggin' Oak Island on both of those sites. Please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. Rate and review us on iTunes. Try my best to get this show in front of as many people as I possibly can. And that seems to be the best way to do that. I appreciate everybody who's done so far. I thank you for your positive ratings, and I thank you for your continued support. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.